Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today, our guest is Dr. Joshua Bennett, the Mellon Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. Dr. Bennett is on New Books in African American Studies to discuss his new book, Being Property, Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man, published in 2020, by Harvard University Press. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bennett.
Thanks for having me, Adam. I appreciate it.
No doubt, no doubt. So, you know, we were talking offline about the origin story of our, you know, friendship here. And so, let's start off. You know, what's the origin story of Being Property, Once Myself? Let's hear about that.
Yeah, so in many ways, the project has a number of divergent origin stories, but the one that immediately comes to mind is where I'm a first-year graduate student at Princeton, and I'm in a seminar on minstrelsy, and we're reading Charles Chestnut's The Conjure Woman and other conjure tales, and I remember reading The Grey Wolf's Haint, reading Poe's Sandy, and thinking about these different tales in which enslaved Black people were transformed into a wide range of creatures, into sort of mud monsters, into wolves, into trees, and thinking about why, you know, at the end of the 19th century, would a Black writer create this sort of world on the page? Why would you turn to plants and to animals, right, for people who had been historically not only compared through racist, denigrating tropes to forms of non-human life, but also who had quite literally been sort of living commodities themselves? Why would you make that sort of counterintuitive move? And that question is one that stuck to me. You know, that first year, I had a hunch that that same kind of opening, that same set of questions or possibilities might be quite prevalent in the Black literary tradition. And it turned out to be true. So starting with Chestnut, moving through Douglas, moving through Henry Bibb, Harriet Jacobs, Harriet Tubman, just thinking as expansively as I could at that moment in my career, I tried to pull together, you know, a bunch of disparate threads around this idea of animality and Blackness as being fundamentally inextricable from one another in the American imagination, and that inextricability being borne out perhaps through the labor of Black letters. So that was the thread I wanted to trace, and that's where Being Property Once Myself began as a project.
And in the, you know, early part of the title, right, Being Property Once Myself, can you talk about where that comes from for those who, you know, might not get that, or even the subtitle as well, which obviously is an important part too.
For sure, for sure. So the title Being Property Once Myself actually comes from an untitled poem in Lucille Clifton's 1972 collection, Good News About the Earth, right, where she says, being property once myself, I have a feeling for it. That's why I can talk about environment. And I was absolutely struck by this passage. You know, at that point, I think I was in my second or third year of graduate school, and I was thinking about the title as a kind of framing device for the dissertation. And I realized that that was it, that this was a project not just about sort of animal imagery in African-American literature, but about that feeling that Lucille Clifton names, What is the feeling that arises in the presence of the animal within the scope of African American literature? How do we name that thing? How do we pursue it? Right. So the dissertation was actually in pursuit of the animal in African American literature. And the move to Blackness and the End of Man in terms of the book project was largely inspired by an extended engagement with the work of Sylvia Winter. Right. So there I'm trying to think about the sort of figures of Man One and Man Two within Winter's oeuvre and really try to think about the figure of man as an over-representation, right? The idea that man sort of masquerades as the only viable vision of the human genre. And so what might we find in Black authors that are willing to turn to figures that have been historically used as sites of derogation? Might we find there another vision of human being and becoming, one that is potentially liberatory and more beautiful, more evocative for those of us that are abolitionists and even just have an abolitionist sort of imagination and a desire for a world, as I say in the book, without cages or chains, right? So that's where I got the title from. And that's what is really motivating the project, I think, that the work of Clifton and Winter in particular, alongside these other authors that I'm looking to in the different chapters.
And so with that, too, talking about inspiration and such, too, I have to go to your acknowledgments, where you thank someone who near to both of our hearts, Dr. Imani Perry. Hey, Dr. Perry, I know you're listening. And also Bill Gleason. And I'll take a part of it from the actual text. And I quote, taking me on, this is where you thank Imani and Bill Gleason for, and I quote, taking me on as an energetic, wide-eyed 22-year-old and helping hone my thinking around the Black environmental imagination. Take us back to those earlier moments. How did Imani Perry and Bill Gleason hone your thinking around the Black environmental imagination?
In so many different ways. So I took an independent study with Imani during my second year at Princeton. And therein, we read, you know, The Known World by Edward P. Jones. We read Legal Theory together. We thought about Toni Morrison. And between her and Bill, who again was helping me really hone my reading and thinking around Chestnut in those earliest stages, I think they just helped me find another language for the pursuit, you know, the central pursuit of the project. They helped me think about Blackness and animality when juxtaposed, not solely as a site of shame. Because that was something I struggled with quite a bit in the beginnings of this project, was what I was after shameful? Did it make sense? Was it something that I was simply imposing on the archive? And even if this was potentially true, even if Black people had historically, you know, turned to animal figures as liberating sites, was that something that we needed to uncover or think about together? Was that actually potentially powerful in any meaningful way? And I think Bill and Imani really encouraged me to leap forward into what my imagination had produced at that moment and what it has continued to in the time since.
Incredible, incredible. And, you know, as folks on the podcast probably know, you know, Dr. Perry, you know, both Dr. Perrys, Dr. Teresa and Dr. Imani, you know, they're incredible, right? And it's funny because I didn't even know who Imani Perry was because I only knew her mother, right? So my introduction was, you know, Dr. Teresa Perry and not Dr. Imani Perry. But I quickly did find out who she was, and it's been a blessing ever since. So, yeah. Hey, Dr. Perry, like I said before, I know you're listening. And so the next question I have for you though is you know, I'm fascinated always with how folks ultimately choose to organize their texts. And so can you describe ultimately how you organize Being Property Once Myself, and you know, dig a little deeper to the writing process involved in constructing such a richly dense text?
Yeah. So the organization of the book was a long, sort of complicated process in many ways, because my first thought was to just go chronologically, you know, in terms of the order in which the central text had been published, right? And that version of things, of course, Their Eyes would be before Native Son, right? But eventually, part of how I started to think about it was in this kind of tripartite model, right? Where I wanted the reader to move from a sort of pest to property to pest, right? Or rather pest to property to pet. And so in doing that, in beginning with the sort of the rat, and with ending, at least in the first iteration, right, in the dissertation with the dog, part of what I was trying to capture there were these sort of tail ends of this spectrum, right? The sort of outright disgust that one experiences in the presence of pestiferous life, moving to the real kind of difficult, fraught intimacy of the pet relationship. And in the middle, really thinking about both the mule and the rooster as these sort of farm animals, right? This idea that they are property on the farm or else like in or near the homestead, right? That for me was the way of thinking about the structural elements of the book. Now, after the dissertation was finished and I'd already begun the process of editing those chapters, looking towards the book, that's when I realized that all the animals that I'd dealt with so far for the most part lived on land. And I had a conversation with one of my cousins, actually, who was incarcerated and had taken a class with Marcus Rediker. And he reached out to me via telephone and he asked if I'd been reading any Marcus Rediker. And of course, I'd been introduced to the work in graduate school. But it was only at that point that I really started thinking seriously about what Rediker calls terracentrism, right? The idea that all important human history has taken place on land. And so then I realized that I had to, you know, take the book underwater, as it were, that it only made sense to end in the blackness beneath the surface of the sea. So it was in part, you know, my cousin's prompting, but then also conversations that I had during my time at the Harvard Society of Fellows with one of my good friends who's a deep sea paleontologist who studies fish at the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. And we were having a conversation where she was just talking at length about the blackness at the bottom of the sea and all of the colors that are there, even in the complete and utter absence of light. And then I thought, well, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's black social life in a certain kind of way, right? All of this robust possibility and color and vibrance that has no real right to exist, right? And yet it does. And so given those twin sort of prompts, right, that come from such radically different places, right? One is this, you know, elite space within an elite space in the Society of Fellows at Harvard. And then there's my cousin, you know, reaching out from federal prison. But both of those conversations really led me to the same place in terms of the construction of the book. So,
wow. That is an incredible story. And, you know, Marcus is a friend and that dude is incredible. What an incredible human being. And so it's just really fascinating to hear how this came to be, because, you know, that was not something that you can necessarily get from the book. All right. And so that's why interviews are really so important. And so as well, thinking about things that also might not necessarily be in the book, talking about challenges, what was the most challenging part about writing and also constructing Being Property Once Myself?
Oh, the most challenging part, I think, was just the actual writing itself, especially for newer books like Salvage the Bones, right, where you aren't working with much, you know, in the way of a secondary criticism. And so you're just sitting with extensive close readings of these various scenes. You want to get it right. The author is still alive, you know, like Jasmine Ward is clearly out there and can read the book and, you know, say this is completely ridiculous, you know, this reading, and just trying to go to war with that. I mean, I was also, Adam, at the same time writing a book of poetry, you know, as I was composing the dissertation, and then writing my second book of poetry as I was editing that dissertation and transforming it into a book. So part of the difficulty too was really giving myself the space to let the poetry feed the prose. While I was in graduate school, you know, some of the more difficult feedback I got in the beginning of my career was around the idea that being a poet meant that people would not take me seriously as a literary scholar, and that the poetry was a distraction. So one of the real struggles I had was to try to make this a book of literary criticism that was rigorous, but also one that had a kind of poetic sensibility that didn't just take poetry seriously, you know, as I tried to throughout the text, you know, looking at Tara Betts and Carl Phillips and Major Jackson and taking up their work throughout, but also really reads with the kind of energy and music of a collection of poetry, You know, poetry was my first love. It was the first genre or form that really spoke to me. You know, my first poets were preachers, and in many ways, those were the first literary critics I ever came across as well. And so I want the book in its best moments to sing like a sermon, you know. And then that's how I close one of the chapters. You know, there's the chapter on Dawes, there's a world beneath the world, and it shimmers. You know, that moment for me is all about the kind of Black theology, Black praise that I grew up with, right? That maybe we were people that have been made to reside at the underside of modernity, you know, but the world we built, the Black social life that we operated in and through every day was irreducibly beautiful. And so I wanted the book to read that way, if at all possible.
And let me tell y'all, as someone who finished the book, you know, not long ago, he did it and did it very well. Right. Let me tell y'all, like, it was just like, I'm just going to be honest with you. I am not someone who reads books multiple times. It just has never honestly been my thing. But clearly, you know, I'm going for the butt. I'm clearly going B-U-T here. And I'm going to have to read it again because there's a lot of, you know, I do work in Black Appalachia, right? I did help do a project down there with the National Park Service and looking at Black life historically and contemporaneously in the spaces around, in and around the present Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And so just thinking about your work and the Black environmental imagination and such, right? Because that was not something that I was trained in undergrad, master's, or even here in my PhD at Rutgers. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, I'm like, damn, like, yo, yeah. Quarantine be damned. I need to, like, you know, add that to, well, unofficially, well, it's, I just said it on the podcast, so I guess it's official now, but add it to the list of things, of things I got to read for my own work, because, you know, your work provides me a lot, and I'm sure there are listeners who will turn into readers, a lot of food for thought about Blackness, property, environment, nature, and also leisure. Because who gets to have leisure time in nature, I think, is very important and also germane to many of the points that you bring up in the book, too. And also, right, I'm not trained as a literary scholar and such, and many of the listeners aren't either. So if you don't mind, can you speak about, you know, what methodologies and also reading practices and such that you haven't necessarily talked fully about yet, did you employ to gain the, you know, the great insights readers will see in Being Property Once Myself?
Yeah. So, I mean, I just going back to Bill Gleason and Imani Perry quickly, they trained me in a certain method of close reading that one, on the one hand, right, takes seriously the idea that literature can help us read the social world, right? And so part of what I was trying to do from the very beginning was not just analyze in a sort of formalistic manner the various formal elements of the text, but really to think about my growing up in South Yonkers, New York, and what that meant for my relationship with dogs, right? In a neighborhood where people engaged in dog fighting. And that was actually my introduction to dogs as pets, right? You're talking about, again, this distinction, right? So this distinction between having a sort of inside and outside dog was also very important. My father is from Alabama, right? Grew up eating Red River clay. My mother is from the South Bronx, right? Grew up in a kitchenette with 7 or 8 other people in it. Around rats and roaches, right? So both of their experiences with animals are widely different, right? And I wanted to be able to bring that experience to bear in the way that I was reading someone like Jesmyn Ward, right? Who somehow pulled off the incredible feat of winning a National Book Award for a book about dog fighting. I mean, I think it's quite the accomplishment, but it's because she writes about it with all of both the ugliness and tenderness that kind of subject matter demands when we look at it within the scope of the Black social sphere, right? People who themselves are given over to these various forms of violence every day are thinking quite differently about interspecies relationships than we might if we only look at it through a dominant frame. So part of the kind of method I was employing in terms of my reading was to let the social worlds of my youth and my adulthood sort of ping back and forth between the text at the level of an interpretation. And also just to bring a wide range of theorists to bear on the way that I was reading, to think with, you know, Black historians, with continental philosophy, with literary theory, as a way to explore the sort of fullness and depth of the text that I was engaging with, you know, to bring disability theory to bear, for example, in the chapter on Song of Solomon, because my master's thesis was on disability studies. Right. And I come from a family. Okay. Yeah. And I come from a family with multiple people with disabilities in it. And so for me, the sort of meta-disciplinary apparatuses of something like animality studies, disability studies, Black studies are always present for me when I read a text. So I'm trying to bring a number of different methodologies to bear. And just quickly on the point you made about leisure, you're making me think about, of course, you know, Christian Cooper. Right. Mm-hmm. This brother that was recently in Central Park trying to take a leisurely stroll and look at some birds. Right. And encounters Amy Cooper and what? Her dog. Right. Mm. And so even there you have this incredible moment. Right. That actually in so many different ways kind of reflects this long history of the intersections of race and species in the United States. Right. You have this white woman that is clearly visibly abusing her companion and her ostensible companion animal, right, on camera. And then you have this Black man and this activity, right, bird watching, which is fundamentally in a certain way about a respectful distance from the unknowable animal, right?
Yep.
Doesn't claim that the birds are his kin, right? Doesn't claim ownership of the birds, right? It's actually about a kind of loving proximity to animal life that is rooted in observation. And to see that clash, right, with Amy Cooper, her simultaneous dehumanization, right, or attempted dehumanization, rather, of this Black male stranger, right, and her clearly inhumane relationship to her own dog, though one imagines she would claim, right, that she's a good liberal and thus loves animals, would never abuse animals, right? You'll call the police to kill a Black man you don't know, but you'd never abuse an animal, right? We see those contradictions laid bare in a moment like that, but also clearly this very fraught history, right? That even simultaneously as we have a white supremacist world in which nature, right, the natural world, animals, plants are subdued in the name of this kind of ecological devastation, alongside labor that's extracted from Black people, you have those same Black folk cultivating what I think at least is a more ethical relationship to the earth. So in the book, I'm trying to hold those things together through the lens of what I'm calling the Black environmental imagination, which is forged in the fire, you know, of that that deprivation and that violence. But on the other side, I think gives us the instruments we need to imagine another world.
And considering, you know, the fire, right, and considering the flames and what's fanning those flames, and thinking about literally what was happening, what, less than, you know, somewhere like 12 to 20 hours ago in Minneapolis and St. Paul and Louisville and, you know, places around the country, you know, things going up in flames. And just thinking about, right, you think about the world that you're imagining in your book, and also just as a human being and as a Black person, just thinking about how those flames provide, you know, not only something to tear down, but just thinking about what will be built anew after that, right? So as I told you offline, it was very fascinating. I stayed up very late. Yeah. Mom, don't listen to this part. I stayed up very late. Like 6-7 in the morning, just because I was like going between reading and just scrolling through Twitter and just seeing everything, like, damn, bro, like, whoa. And there's a way that the quarantine kind of is supposed to provide you a distance from things that this moment just tells you that it you can't, right? Everybody has a role to play. Not everyone will be in the streets. We do understand that. But it's like that distance is being is being torn down. And your book makes me think a lot about property, blackness, anti-blackness, and what does property, what does it mean to have once been property? And now you see that same kind of private property being torn down. And you, as the former, you know, quote unquote, former property, are the ones doing it, right? Yes. Just thinking about just that kind of relationship is something that I was like, yo, reading your book while doing it, like, that's something I will not forget.
Yeah.
Wow. Like at all.
Thank you for that. That means a great deal, brother. I mean, in part two, because even the sort of criticisms we're seeing, right, of protester engagement in Minneapolis largely seem to me, at least the tone from some of what I read, is condescending, right? Deeply condescending, and clearly tied to this idea, right, that Black people used to be property, right, and need to act according to white mandates, right, no matter what, in every single situation. They're always in a position to be pandered to, right, by everyone. And they're also in a position to be themselves summarily destroyed. I mean, you saw these tweets, right, these President Trump tweets, right, about bringing in the military and that weird sort of rhyme he threw in there about looting and shooting, right?
I was like, yeah.
Blew my mind. I was like, all right, this is not television. Why are you trying to throw out catchphrases about mass killing, right? But again, it's this, it has everything to do with the ostensible relation between Black people and white civil society, right? The idea that these people have acted out of order, they have acted ungratefully, and they must be continuously ritually killed, right? And then punished after the fact, if they dare to protest that injustice.
Yeah, no, that was something that I literally read. I was like, hold on. He ain't no philosopher. He ain't no none of that. But that just, there was a melody to it that just seemed ghostly. And it also makes me think about, you know, to connect another part of your book, thinking about the role of fugitivity plays in being property once myself. So can you talk about the role fugitivity plays in your understanding of not only our world, but also the world that's being constructed in being property once myself, if you can?
No, 100%. So, I mean, at the moment in graduate school when I chose fugitivity as a frame for the book, I was reading a ton of Nate Mackey and Fred Moten, and trying to think about what would happen if we extended some of those insights, particularly around Black art and Black performance, to the non-human world, right? That part of what someone like Henry Bibb, for example, was describing when he talked about his envy of the animal was particularly its capacity for fugitive flight, right? So he would say, you know, if a white man attacks me, I have no recourse, right? But the bird can fly away, right? The snake can attack and poison him, right? So it's this idea that there are all these potentials, not just for escape, but also subversion, right? A kind of fugitive potential that was imminent to animal life that became a site of sometimes real envy, right? In the text that I'm interested in, but also a site of commonality, right? To take flight like the wolf, to take flight like the eagle, like any other form of sort of like bird life, for example. And I was compelled by that idea that fugitivity was actually a site of interspecies coalition in a way to think with animals differently, right, than what I'd seen so far in the field of animal studies, which is originally really where I thought I was going to find my home. But I realized that more of what I was interested in is what Michael Lundblad in his book, Birth of the Jungle, calls animality studies, right? I was actually interested in these sort of historical and otherwise moments of overlap between human and non-human animals and what sort of new theoretical possibilities and opportunities they produced. And fugitivity there for me seemed like a concept that absolutely had everything to do with not just human forms of life, but with these non-human forms of sociality that I'm also trying to explore in the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it makes me think a lot as well, just about not only fugitivity and flight and environment, but also just the nature of Black freedom, right? Yeah. What, you know, and just to ask you plainly, what kind of world are you? What kind of world do you want? Right. I heard someone cited in your book was asked that on the Teray show, Teray being, you know, the amazing podcast host and writer, asked your mentor, I'm sure, Mark Lamont Hill, that. Right. And I remember listening to that and trying to think about his answer. And so I'm asking you as a, you know, as a mentee, you know, being asked that now, right, of him, what world are you trying to build? And what does Black mean in that project?
Yeah, I mean, so the world I'm trying to build, I think, is tied to the book as a work of literary theory, but also extends beyond it. You know, so on the one hand, as an abolitionist, and as someone that's been an abolitionist for really, I think, since I was a little boy, in part because my older brother was incarcerated when I was quite young. And so I've always thought about what it means that in a world where, one, we all commit criminal acts, you know, every day. Many of us, you know, jaywalk on the way to work, etc., right? And we live on stolen land, right? And so part of what I've been trying to think about is how all of my theoretical projects, all of my poems can hopefully contribute to a vision of a world without prison and a world without police, right? And carceral institutions, again, are not just limited to the human world. So I think about this with zoos, of course, with aquariums, and just the ways in which animal captivity is sort of built into the human social world in ways that we not just can visibly see, right, but actually pay to attend, and how that becomes almost the kind of really the opposite in some ways of prisons, which are often kept out of sight, right? This idea that human captivity takes place, you know, far beyond our everyday vision. And so the world I'm trying to build is a freer one. On the one hand, right? I'm also, I think, trying to see a world in which poetry is just taken much more seriously, where poetry is something that's an intimate part of an American education in particular, right? I think we're living in a moment in which we see the denigration of our language happening in real time in ways that are absolutely devastating. And learning to read poetry carefully, thoughtfully, lovingly, was something that transformed our relationship to language. I think it taught me how to read. It taught me how to write. It taught me how to speak. It taught me how to teach, right? So another part of the world I'm trying to build is one where we can make time for beauty and we can give our hours over to that pursuit.
And you speak about teaching. And obviously the other side of this coin is that you are a teacher. So can you talk about, you know, how do elements of being property once myself, right? How do they make it into your classroom, right? As you know, as a professor at Dartmouth.
Sure. So I teach a class. The first class I actually ever taught at Dartmouth was called The Black Outdoors. And so,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Inspired, you know, by J. Cameron Carter, Sarah Jane Servanek, right? And their book series, but also this brilliant series of talks they had at Duke where they interviewed, you know, Sadia Hartman, Fred Moten, and others. And so part of what we're trying to think about that course is we're really trying to think about Black environmentalism as a kind of through line through Black literary studies, right? We're watching The Woods episode of Atlanta. We're watching Moonlight. We're reading Their Eyes Are Watching God, but also Zora's essay on, you know, the pet Negro, right? We're reading Maud Martha by Gwendolyn Brooks and thinking about not just the passage where she talks about, you know, these beautiful flowers and buttons and other objects, but also the chapter Maud Martha Spares the Mouse, right? And the Black kitchenette historically as a site of both intimacy and great terror, right? We're reading Camille Dungy's brilliant 2009 anthology, Black Nature, right? And trying to think about what it means that you can have 400 years of Black nature poems in a book and yet instill someone can be surprised that Christian Cooper loves to go look at birds. You know what I mean? Or that he's, you know, on the Audubon Society in New York City. Or that, you know, people are surprised to hear that Frederick Douglass, you know, and this is the way I opened the book, right? But was someone that cared very deeply about animals and had them as a major part of his political project. And so for me, part of what I've been trying to put together in my teaching is exposing these ideas to students. You know, I also taught a class on Black love, right, where we had an entire section on prison abolition, where we're reading George Jackson and the poetry of Dwayne Betts, and we're reading essays and interviews from Assata Shakur and Angela Davis, right, and trying to think about how do Black people love each other in the era of mass incarceration, right, where so many of us have our, you know, mothers and sisters and sons and daughters and brothers and fathers and friends locked in cages, you know, and disproportionately so, but because they're Black, right? How do we take that seriously, right? How do we read If Beale Street Could Talk, you know, now decades later through that lens of the era of mass incarceration? How do we think about the sort of alternate ending that Barry Jenkins creates on screen and how that's inflected perhaps by mass incarceration? These are the kind of classes I'm teaching, and it's been an incredible experience, you know, for so many different reasons on that front. I taught a contemporary American poetry class that had over 50 students in it. And, you know, we watched Slam, you know, the Saul Williams. And it was just kind of amazing to get the chance to teach, you know, spoken word alongside, you know, Wanda Coleman and Terrence Hayes and, you know, all these brilliant Black contemporary poets, Harriet Mullen and Vibe Francis and Gregory Pardlow, and have my students read that work together, largely having, again, no formal training in poetry at any point in high school or college up to that moment, right? But yearning for that, saying, I wish I knew how to read poetry. Almost all of them wrote poetry, which was amazing. I had them write a poem before every class session. You know, we were free write together for about 10 to 15 minutes. But many of them were, you know, amateur poets on their own. Right. But with no idea how to turn that into something that not even necessarily was a professional pursuit, but something that they could feel good about as a craft practice. Right. So part of what I'm trying to do as a teacher is just assure people that you can do that, that you can have, you know, a day job and be a poet, or you can be a full time poet as I was, you know, from ages 19 to 30, pretty much. You know, I just started at Dartmouth about a year and a half, and you know, I'll be 32 this summer. And so for much of my life, really, since I was a teenager, I made my living on the road, you know, as a poet, as someone that was performing sometimes in rooms with 10 people in it, sometimes in, you know, concert venues with over 1,200 people in them. And I want my students to understand that those spaces exist, that people still gather to do this ancient thing, you know, called the, you know, making of poems and the recitation of poems, and that that's a wholly political transformative thing. So that's a large part of my teaching praxis, you know, is to introduce those ideas and to just learn from these, you know, brilliant, generous students, you know, that I'm so blessed to have the chance to collaborate with. You know, my students, they've changed my life. They've transformed my perspective. And I think they've kept me honest as a scholar. They've made me open up my language. And they've made me think critically about my politics, you know, at every turn, lest I get comfortable or think I have it all figured out. You know, my students regularly push me to be more engaged, more thoughtful, and more courageous. They hold me to the standards of the writers that I teach and that I share with them, right? So when one of the first texts you give your students in a Black Outdoors class is Sylvia Winter's No Humans Involved, right? you have to think about that in its proper context of her writing that as an open letter to her colleagues at Stanford, you know, in the wake of the Rodney King beating. How do you model that in your own life? How do you operate in that kind of courage and dynamism and imagination? You know, I think that happens in the classroom. You know, those kind of questions get forwarded and you have to take them seriously.
And speaking of that kind of environment, right, we're living in that environment right now. What would a letter like that look like right now, right? In as things are, you know, literally on fire, and as, you know, we're trying to get justice for, you know, not black men, but black people, right? People out there on Facebook and Twitter and everything. And just trying to just change our understanding of the possible in our world. And it actually makes me go to a passage from your book on page 139, where you're discussing Hurston. And this is what you write. There is no bond unmarred by blood. This, for Hurston, is the work of the figure of the mule as a problem for thought. How we might collaborate across unfathomable distance and think about difference not as an occasion for domination, but as an opportunity to sketch a dying world anew. End quote.
Yeah.
That to me, among the amazingness of the about 200 words that you have on the page, that really struck me, right? As I said, I was reading that last night. And you spoke about this obviously in your other answers, but if you can, in the time that we have remaining, in what ways can we think better about futures where difference is not commodified and dominated?
Yeah. Oh, in what ways can we do that? You're asking?
Yeah. Because I'm sure there are some people that are thinking, right, what are things that people can do? Or even, right, imagine that the people that are listening are in your classroom at Dartmouth.
Oh, that's a difficult question. I mean, I think for me, the only way I've ever done it is by getting outside, one, a familiar institutional space, I guess, is part of the way that I've tried to do it. So I think my first encounters with so many of the ideas that transformed my life happened in poetry slams, strangely enough. You know, like really thinking about anti-imperial struggle, thinking about U.S. militarism, thinking more in depth about sort of queer studies, disability theory, critical theory as such. A lot of that didn't even happen in the classroom for me in college. A lot of that was going to these poetry slams with people from the community in Philadelphia that were from all across the city, all across the world, but had gathered in the name of the art form, right? So part of I think the work of creating that sort of scenario that you're describing, I mean, in the scene you're thinking about with Hurston, the sentence right before that is about this idea that there is no communion with the animal without sort of facing the prospect of your own death, right? Because it's not cute, right? Relation is not cute. And here I'm thinking about Edward Glissant thinking about sort of colliding opacities when he talks about relation, right? Relation is about difficulty. It's not about sort of naming one's privilege or even thinking about, I think, various sort of identities necessarily at the same time and how they intersect or overlap one another, or in what ways am I in a dominant relationship to another person, and stopping there, right? It has to do with the difficulty of communicating across that great divide of, one, paying what is owed, right? And here I'm thinking about reparation, not just as a sort of set of material quantities, but as an aesthetic and as an ethics, right? How do we repair our world? How do we repair our relationships to one another? And how do we understand that there are social and otherwise debts that need to be paid, right? I think that's one way that we can think about difference without domination. But also, how do we get comfortable with opacity, right? With saying there are things not only that we don't know about one another, but that we can't know and that we don't need to know, right? How do we really encounter the mystery of other people in a meaningful way and understand that difference is not just not an occasion for a dominion, but it's actually an opportunity for surprise and wonder and astonishment, right? And how incredible that is. What a marvel that is, that every day we get to encounter the unknown in each other. How do we think about that as a sort of grounds for organizing, reading together, thinking together, right? Not what we have in common necessarily, but what makes us radically divergent from one another and opaque to one another, right? That's what I'm in pursuit of in this book, you know? Mm.
Absolutely. And one of the last couple of questions I have for you too,
sure.
And you peppered it throughout the our discussion too, but what and or who inspires you to do the work that you do and to keep yourself going, right?
Mm. Wow, so many different people, living or dead or both?
Both. Let's go both.
Okay, well, I mean, we got to start with my mama. You already know.
I already know.
All day, every day. Shout out to, you know, BX, Yonkers as well. Got to be my mom. Got to be my older sister, you know, my father, my little brother, all of my family and my closest friends. In part because I think they just keep me honest. You know, the first people to hear my job talk were my parents. You know, my parents are about 70 years old, both of them. And I delivered this 40-minute job talk for them, which was fairly dense, but they sat through the whole thing. We did a Q&A. And I think that was just an important reminder for me that we have to be accountable into the academy to the people that love us, right? And the people that made us possible, even the people that don't necessarily love us, right? But the communities we come from, right? And even the communities we don't come from, Black people all across the world, we're accountable to them. Our work needs to be accountable to them, which for me doesn't mean it has to be less rigorous. It means it actually needs to be more rigorous because the problems we're up against are monumental, right? So my family inspires me. June Jordan inspires me every day. My sense when reading her poetry and essays in graduate school was that she was probably the most sort of under-theorized person in Black literary studies. So part of my hope for the future is that more and more people really pay close attention to June Jordan's oeuvre. Sylvia Winter, Lucille Clifton, I've already mentioned. Gwendolyn Brooks, I gestured toward briefly, but of course I'm inspired not just by her poetry and prose, but also her commitment to people in street organizations, to children, to people who are considered to be less than nothing within the scope of white civil society. Gwendolyn Brooks believed that those people were smart and beautiful and worthy of study and care and recognition. And so I hope to model, you know, even just some quantity of that kind of a radical transformative love in my life. Imani Perry, Bill Gleason, Elaine Scarry, who else? So many. Oh, I mean, my grandmother who passed on, you know, at the beginning of this pandemic. And I say this a little bit in the acknowledgments, but part of the inspiration for the book cover was actually her and my grandfather who met in a strawberry field before they moved to New York City where they would build a family. And I've thought quite often recently about the fact that my grandmother had dementia before she died. And part of the way her caretaker says she imagined herself in those last days was as a teenage girl running through those fields, you know, as a even in the midst of sort of being a sharecropper, right? She was able to find love and beauty in that space. And so much of what inspires me when I think back on her legacy is that incredible imaginative capacity, that meditative tenacity, right? To be in that space of what some would consider utter abjection and somehow be able to not just find love, but create it, you know, out of the air. She went on to, when she came up north, she ran a beauty salon that I grew up in, and all of the women there would pay me a dollar if I could spell a word with a, you know, three or more syllables. So, you know, I would say, you know, recalcitrant, metonymic, you know, loquacious. Loquacious was my favorite word when I was 5 years old. And so I'm inspired too by the fact that she was willing to use that space as one in which she could cultivate the sort of imaginary life world of a little boy and believe that he could be somebody. So this book is for her, and so is the work of my life. Mm.
Beautiful, man. And you know, that was one thing that caught my eye too, because if I'm not mistaken, you know, they met in Wilmington, North Carolina, right?
Sir, yes, sir.
That's my family stomping grounds. So my family is from Columbus County, New Brunswick County, you have Hanover County or New Hanover County, which is in Wilmington, and so that's right in the area where my family comes from. And then you think about David Walker, you think about, you know, just the, you know, the only quote unquote full coup in American history. And so it's just thinking about Wilmington as an important space, right, of birth and of struggle. And so that's what I hear, and that's what I imagine as well with your grandmother as well. And so we'll go out on this one, right? What was the most rewarding experience of writing Being Property Once Myself? It's out in the world. Yeah. New Books in African American Studies listeners, we're going to support Dr. Bennett here, my man's, my OG here, you know what I'm saying? So tell us about what the most and it doesn't have to be one, right? Tell us about some rewarding experiences of writing Being Property Once Myself.
So one was getting the page proofs in the middle of a snowstorm in Boston, and my fiance did a photo shoot with me and the book and with our dog Apollo. And I don't know, for some reason there was something about that just felt like everything I dreamt of wanting in my life sort of coming together, right? With this new home and this new space that we built, this book that I dedicated the last 8 years of my life to, you know, from that first seminar in 2012 to its arrival in 2020, that felt incredibly rewarding, even though it was, you know, just the proofs, you know, that felt like something tremendous. And to have it celebrated by the people closest to me, who again are, you know, are not academics, right? Which I don't know, I think that's important, because part of the question it seems like you were asking earlier as well about the kind of world I want to make is also about the future of the humanities, right? And the future of the kind of work that both you and I seek to undertake, right? As historians, as literary critics, how are we endeavoring to make the world a freer place? And how are we making our work legible to people, right, that don't operate within the academy, you know? So I think part of what was so rewarding was to get that proof, to have someone I love and respect and admire, you know, hi Pam, to have my fiance say, you know what, like, we're really going to celebrate. Because for me, I think I was just going to take a picture of the book and post it, and that was going to be it. And she said, no, like, we need to celebrate, put on a fit, go outside, we're going to do a whole thing. And I think it reminded me that it's okay, not just that it's okay to celebrate when you accomplish milestones like that, but that is necessary. It's absolutely and completely necessary when you do something like finish a book that you have to honor that moment, you know? So that was incredibly satisfying and brought me great joy. What else? I think just every moment where one of my friends, where a former mentee has sent me a picture of themselves with a book, that's meant a big deal. Imani tweeting me, you know, retweeting with comments, you know, my picture of the book and asking people to teach it, in part because I don't know that I'd really considered that idea that someone would teach my book, you know, this thing that used to be a PDF on my laptop for many, many years in various permutations, right? So those are off the top of my head. Those are some of the most satisfying moments. And those have been, you know, kind of hard to come by, you know, in the midst of the pandemic. And so I don't take it lightly, you know, and I'm incredibly thankful for it.
Hey man, and I'm thankful to have you on New Books in African American Studies, because your book to me encapsulates African American Studies, right? The core, right? Wow. You talk about Cornel West, right? Race matters in your acknowledgments, and thinking about, you know, the corpus of West and his importance to the field and such as well. And so to me, I see your book, and just to let you know too, as a shameless plug, each Friday night we get together for a hashtag quarantine happy hour, you know, what's up Antoine and Aya and all the crew, where we just honestly just kick back and as professors, grad students, and other folks throughout the world, or mostly throughout the country, we just chop it up. And one of the things I told the folks last week before I got off was, yo, I got Dr. Josh Bennett on here, you know what I'm talking about? It's about to be flames. And so, and that's, you know, we do that on Zoom every Friday, beginning around 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And so, you know, when I think about the kind of books and what keeps us going and what provides us an understanding of what we're fighting for and who we are thinking with, right, historically and contemporaneously, Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man, in this moment, child, please, you already know we gotta boost this one.
Wow. I am honored. We need to have you blurb the next one, man, because that got me hype.
Hey, man. Hey.
Mark Flex, DJ Clue, you know, level promo.
Well, look at it this way, right? Look at it this way. We'll call you Black Thought because you got the beard, and I'll be Flex. Let's think about it that way. You know, you hit us with the 15-minute no breath freestyle Black Thought, you know what I'm saying? You Philly affiliated. And then, you know, I'll just be Funk Flex in the background saying, that's bars. That's bars. You know what I'm saying? I got hair, but I ain't bald. But, you know, I think people understand the aesthetic here.
Yeah, no, I feel the energy, brother. I feel that energy 100%. Man, young Tariq Trotter, I appreciate that. Let me know if you ever get the connect, because I have respect. That's an all-world lyricist right there. So thank you.
Look, man. Yeah, no, for real, man. And so, you know, this has been such a great conversation, y'all. And once again, we have had the amazing opportunity to discuss with Dr. Joshua Bennett and his brand new book published by our friends at Harvard University Press. Please go get it. Go support them, buy the book. And that book is Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man. And Dr. Bennett is the Mellon Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. And y'all, if you enjoy this podcast, New Books in African American Studies, why don't you go and rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts? Let us know how we're doing. Right. Because we need to know how in this moment, if we're satisfying your need, or even if there's a book that you want us to go interview the author about. Thank God I've already knew Dr. Bennett. And I'm sure there are other books out there that you all want us to go and interview folks for. So please go and do that. And once again, folks, my name is Adam McNeil, PhD student at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Over and out.